When I was growing up, I remember watching reruns of a show called Lost in Space. Some of you who are older may remember that. And one of the main features of this show was this robot that would wander around. And the only thing I remember about this robot is every once in a while it would kind of wave its arms crazy and say, "Danger, Will Robinson." And the problem I always wondered about was he never said what the danger was. It was kind of like Lassie barking. You know, Lassie barks and all of a sudden like, "What? Timmy's stuck in the well? How do you know that from the dog barking? That's what I want to know." But we also drive down the side. And so I imagine this robot running around saying, "Danger, danger." And it's a warning sign, kind of like when we drive down the road. Earlier this year, or last year, the bridge collapsed over there on Simonelli. And so there were signs up, "Bridge out." Or actually, it just said, "Road closed." And if you didn't know what that was for, you might not realize that it's because the bridge had collapsed. Or you're driving down the road, and you see a little light come up on your dashboard. And some of us say, "Oh, just ignore it and keep going," right? Or we call somebody and say, "There's a light on my dashboard. What do I do?" But a warning sign is there to tell us something. Tell us something's going wrong or that there's some danger up ahead. But it's one thing to simply know there's a danger ahead. But the other thing we need to know is, what do we do? How do we respond to this danger? How do we respond to this thing? If it's a little easier to say, "Well, the road's slippery," and so we think, "Oh, we should probably slow down." But we know that because we've been told. Or we see the light on the dashboard and we say, "Oh, I know what I'm supposed to do when I see that light." Or whatever the warning signs are. And so we're going to look a little bit today about warning signs, but also then, what do we do with those warning signs? The book of Hebrews is what we've been studying, and it talks about the need to persevere in the midst of discouragement and drifting. And in the midst of that, it's talking about how do we do that. And so we're going to look a little bit at a warning, but then what do we do with these warnings? And Hebrews is filled with a number of warning passages, these kind of "be careful because of." But it's one thing, again, to say, "Oh, we have to be careful. There's some danger." But then the question we have to ask is, how do I respond to that danger? What should I do to this warning sign? And so again, we're in the book of Hebrews, and the kind of what's happened up to this point is we've learned that Jesus shows us who God is, and that Jesus understands us, and we're called to strive to enter into God's rest, into his presence. And Jesus guides and helps us, and Jesus, because he was a human being, can sympathize, and he understands, he can help us to help find mercy. And at the near the end of chapter 5, it talks about Jesus, and it's mentioned him a couple times, serving as a high priest. In chapter 5, verse 10, he says, "And he was designated by God to be a high priest in the order of Melchizedek," which is the phrase we just heard. And you think, "Oh, who is this Melchizedek, and what are we going to do with him?" And you're getting excited about it. And then the preacher, the writer, goes off on a detour. He kind of says, "Well, not yet. You're not quite ready for that yet." And so, in the same way, we're not quite ready for it yet. We're going to talk about Melchizedek next week, and who is this strange guy, and what's this weird name that's going on. But what happens at, that's in verse chapter 5, verse 10, 5:11, the preacher goes on and says, "Well, we have much to say about this." In other words, much to say about this Melchizedek, the high priest, and what it means that Jesus is a high priest. In fact, we're going to spend about 4 chapters talking about why is Jesus high priest, and who's Melchizedek, and how does that all connect together? But he begins off, he says, "But it's hard to make it clear to you because you no longer try to understand." He's kind of speaking to his class, because if you imagine this as a sermon or maybe a class, and I think back to college, and it was my senior year, I took a class on mechanical drawing and drafting, and it was at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I had been up that the day the class took place, I was in the Reserve Officer Training Corps, ROTC, and so I was up at like 5 in the morning. And I'd go to my training that morning, and then I had classes all morning, and then I'd run and grab some lunch and then go back to a 1 o'clock class. Now you can imagine sitting in a 1 o'clock afternoon class after getting up early in the morning and having just eaten lunch, what that's like. And so the professor, Professor Slaby, the mechanical drawing, these were the days of chalkboard still. We had chalkboard, and he had this big, long plastic stick that he would use to draw with. Well, the thing was, this plastic stick was kind of flexible too. And so every once in a while, I know I'd start to kind of feel my head getting a little heavy and start to drop off. And Professor Slaby would kind of see me in the background. It wasn't a big class. There were only about 8 or 10 of us in this class. This was not a class you could hide in. And so as he was drawing a line, he'd take that plastic ruler and he'd kind of pull it back like this and let it go against the chalkboard. And it made a really loud noise. And they'd kind of jump up. And that's kind of what the writer here is doing. He's saying, hey, pay attention. You're not listening to what's going on. He says, it's hard to make it clear to you because you're no longer trying to understand. Your ears are dull. Your ears are sluggish. You're not listening. He's saying, this is important, but you aren't paying attention. And he's saying, this isn't just obscure theology, because it might be tempting to think the preacher's going on. He says, oh, he's a high priest in the order of Melchizedek. And you just say, oh my word, what is that all about? And you just start to tune out. And the preacher said, no, you need to pay attention to this. And why is it important to pay attention? And so kind of a brief summary of chapter 5, verse 11 through 6, 12 of what's going on, which leads us in to the passage that Aaron read today. And the passage begins with this challenge for people to spiritual maturity. He's saying you need to move on and move into maturity. And maturity is not simply effectiveness or popularity, but it's about moving forward in life. He says, in fact, though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you the elementary truth of God's word all over. You need milk, not solid food. And it's this picture of saying, here you are, you're sitting and you're growing up and you still got your bottle and your baby food. You're past that stage. Now, there's nothing wrong with having been in that stage. I mean, everybody is a baby and we start with those things, but you can't keep eating that way. You can't be going that way. And so he says, we need to move on to maturity. Maturity, first of all, is marked by someone who can teach. You think, well, I'm not a teacher. But I think what the preacher's getting at is we need to move beyond the place in our walk with Jesus where we're just always taking in. But where are we sharing it? Are we able to tell other people about Jesus? We should be doing that. And also, the other mark of maturity is somebody who can distinguish good from evil. That's in chapter 5, verse 14. That we can tell the difference between right and wrong. That's a mark of maturity, that as we go through our life and there's difficult things going on, that we can notice the difference between those two. And then what he does is he kind of goes on, he says, but you're stuck. He says this, therefore, let us move beyond the elementary teachings about Christ and be taken forward to maturity, not laying again the foundation of repentance from acts that lead to death and of faith in God. In other words, they're the basic teachings we all need to know, including repentance and faith in God. And we start there, but we can't stay there. We have this relationship with God, and we need to build on that relationship. We need to develop it. We need to build on what you know. There's a foundation, and the foundations are the start, but we have to strengthen and maintain it and move past them. In other words, we can't live on yesterday's faith. We can't simply say, oh, I remember back at youth group when I was 17 and I walked forward and I gave my life to Jesus. And he said, that's a good thing. That's a good start that you understood that. But now you're in your 40s. Your faith should have moved on from that point when you were 17. Now, it doesn't mean that we're all called to be at the same place or that we're all going to necessarily be at the same place. But he's speaking to each individual and saying, think back. And he doesn't necessarily just mean like think back yesterday, but think back over the last couple years, the last 4 years, the last 5 years, the last 10 years, and say, am I becoming mature in my faith? Am I better able to distinguish right from wrong? Am I growing in my faith and understanding things more? And more importantly, even living it out. He's challenging this congregation. Then he gives a warning, this encouragement to grow, and talks about not shrinking back or turning away. When there's persecution, when there's struggles, and the truth is we all have struggles in our faith. I mean, that's a part of following Jesus. There are going to be struggles in our life. And it may be a theological struggle. We're struggling with the question of evil or how that works. We're struggling with why we prayed for someone and they didn't get better. We're struggling with how we share our faith with someone and they just don't want to listen to it. Maybe we're struggling because we have our own doubts and we're uncertain about things. Maybe we're feeling like it's harder and harder to share our faith with people, or the way we're living is causing us difficulties at work or in school. And he's saying that's a part of it, but he's saying we need to continue on and not turn away. Because if we turn away from Christ, that is a turn from God's blessing and towards judgment. And it's a harsh picture of warning, but it's all designed for that thing to encourage the people, saying, you don't want to turn away. And he's not talking about, when it's talking about this turning away, it's not kind of like, oh, I made a mistake. It's like, oh, I turned away because I had this thing I did yesterday. He's talking about a deliberate, intentional turn away from Christ and saying, no, I'm done with that. He's saying, when you do that, there's a chance that you might never come back. And it might seem easier sometimes to not follow Jesus, because sometimes you think, well, if I follow Jesus, that means I got to be honest here. And if I just fudge the numbers a little bit here, I'd do much better. Or if I just lied a little bit about this, or I did this way, life would be so much easier. But the preacher's saying, that's the road to destruction. But then goes on and kind of flips back after the big warning, after kind of waving his arms around saying, warning, danger. He says, even though we speak like this, dear friends, we are convinced of better things in your case, the things that have to do with your salvation. He's saying, you can do this. It's kind of this mode of where he's warned them and said, oh, that's a really bad thing, but it's okay, you got this. You can do this. I want you to keep up and press forward. Goes on in verses 10, 11, he says, we want each of you to show this same diligence at the very end. He said, or verse 10, God is not unjust. He will not forget your work and the love you have shown him as you have helped his people and continue to help them. He points back and he says, you've been doing the things God has called you to do. Now keep it up. Keep moving forward in your faith. Keep demonstrating those things that you're doing. And this is the point at which maybe we start to think, oh, is it all up to me? Because it can start to sound like, well, if I don't do all these things, if I start to drift away, then how does it seem all up to me? Or we're worried about we're falling away. We're facing persecution. We're facing difficulties. We're facing pressure, and we're worried. Well, I'm going to fall away. How do I do it? And so this is that part where the warning light is flashing, where it's saying, don't turn away from Jesus when persecution comes. Don't turn away when there's hardships because you might never come back. And you say, but how do I do that? And the good thing is the writer doesn't just leave us with that. Doesn't just leave us with the question, well, how do I avoid becoming sluggish? How do I avoid becoming lazy? What do I do when it gets hard? It's inviting us to ask, how do we maintain our commitment for the long haul? Because life with Jesus is a long haul. Or Eugene Peterson, the writer, he borrows a phrase from another writer and refers to it as the long obedience in the same direction. Saying, this life with Jesus begins at a place, but it's a lifelong experience, a long obedience in the same direction. And how do we maintain that when the challenges come, when the doubts come, when the worries come, when the pressure comes, when the persecution comes, all those different things, how do we maintain that? And that's where we come today. He begins to hint at it. He says, we do not want you to become lazy. I like that. He's like, it looks at me. Imagine the preacher standing up there. It's like, okay, stop being lazy. We don't want you becoming lazy. But we want you to imitate those who through faith and patience inherit what has been promised. How do you avoid becoming lazy? Through faith and patience. Which are these generic? What do we do with those things? These will keep us going. Faith and patience will keep us going. They'll keep us following Jesus when we don't want to. They'll keep us following Jesus when we struggle. When it's hard. When there's those times when we want to trust our instincts, when we want to listen to someone else instead of listening to Jesus. It'll keep us for the long haul. At which point we might think, oh, that sounds great and all. But those are kind of vague. Those are these abstract principles, kind of like, oh, have faith, have patience. Well, what does that look like? And why these particular things? So faith and patience, or we could say trust and patience. And so what the writer, the preacher does is kind of say, well, I'm going to give you an example of it. I want you to understand, what does faith and patience look like? And so he starts talking about Abraham. But the thing is, the story is not really about Abraham. We're going to see what happens. It's less about faith and patience, because we think about Abraham as patient. He says, well, Abraham was an example of patience. So let's go back to the story of Abraham. Just a quick reminder of what happened in the Old Testament. God comes to Abraham this wandering person, and he says, you're going to be the part of my rescue plan. You're going to be the key member of it, and I'm going to make you into a great nation. I'm going to give you descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore, and I'm going to make you into a great nation and bless you, and through you all the nations on earth are blessed. This is in Genesis chapter 12. And at this point, Abraham is in his 70s. He and his wife are both older, no kids. And so God says, you're going to have a great nation born to you. And it's like, well, you got to have at least one kid to do that, right? And so how does Abraham demonstrate patience? Well, about 15 years go by and still no children. At this point, Abraham says, well, I'm going to take things into my own hand. So he abuses his servant girl or his slave girl, Hagar, and has a child through her. That was not God's plan. So we think, well, Abraham was not. So then it's another number of years pass by until Abraham is almost 100 when finally he has his son Isaac. So 25 years. So you think, well, was he patient or was he not patient? Well, kind of, but not really, right? But it's a story about who God is. And we think about this story and it reminds us what God is like, that God will do what he promises. And so part of it is when we think about our discipleship to Jesus, one of our biggest problems often is we have a skewed picture of who God is. When we don't understand who God is, it challenges us to follow. And so what the writer, what the preacher wants to see is like, it's about Abraham and his faith and his trust, but it's also more importantly pointing us to why can we trust God? Why should we put our faith in him? And so he goes on and here's that story. He says, when God made his promise to Abraham, and so this is, if you want to read Genesis 12, Genesis 15, Genesis 17, Genesis 22, this whole story, although the main part is Genesis 22 when he finally has his son, and then there's this whole story where he has his son Isaac, and then God says, okay, I want you to take your son, your only son, as if he didn't know he only had one son. Take your only son, and I want you to go sacrifice him. And that's a long, complicated story, but Abraham listens to what God has said. He has faith, and because later on in Hebrews it says, because he trusted that God could raise the dead, he takes him, but God says, no, I see now that you trust me. And then God swears an oath, and this is what it goes. He says, he swore by himself, saying, I will surely bless you and give you many descendants. And so after waiting patiently, we use patiently in quotes there, Abraham received what was promised. So let's stop and remind ourselves kind of the big picture, what's going on. Why is he telling this story? Why is the preacher telling this story? Because we've been called to grow in our maturity. We've been called not to drift, not to turn away. But that takes faith and patience. And so the question is, how do we cultivate faith and patience? Now, many of us have had kids, grandkids. How many of you have experienced those children, grandchildren, or maybe a coworker, somebody at, you know, in school, not being patient? It's ever happened to anyone? Okay. So how well does it work when you just say, be patient? It scares them, but do people instantly become patient when you just tell them to be? No. So if the writer were just simply to say, if I were to just simply say, hey, God wants you to trust him. Sometimes the promises take a while, and that's part of it is saying, and it took a while for Abraham. It's learning, growing in faith is being patient for God to gain his promises. And you come to me and you say, Pastor, you call and say, hey, can I talk to you about something? And so we sit down in my office and you say, you know, I've got this thing and I know God promised this, but I'm struggling because it's been years now. And I just looked at you and said, be patient. You say, well, what? I mean, what? I said, be patient. Is that helpful at all? No, it's not. And so when the writer says, be patient, he's saying, how do we cultivate patience? And he's saying, we have to remind ourselves of who God is. That's how we grow in patience. We remind ourselves of who God is. And he uses the story of Abraham to get to that. And so we have in the story, it says, God swears by himself. So you say, so help me, right? As God stands up. Well, what is it? What is it talking about? And it's talking about God is trustworthy. And so when it talks about that, it says, since there was no one greater for him to swear by, he swore by himself. Does God need to make an oath? No. But what God is doing is condescending to human beings. And human beings take oaths. And he's going to say more about that in chapter 6, verse 16. He says, People swear by someone greater than themselves, and the oath confirms what is said and puts an end to all argument. And so we are familiar with this concept, at least in part. I mean, somebody goes into the courtroom. And what do they often do? You know, put their hand on a Bible, or somebody takes an oath of office and they put their hand on the Bible or another holy book and they say, you know, so help me God, right? And it's an oath, it's a swearing. And in what in some sense it's doing is saying, this higher power is calling me to account. This higher power is what's holding me responsible. In fact, in the ancient Near East, in the times of Abraham, they would make these covenants, they would make these oaths, and there was this elaborate process that they would go through. And one part of that process was oftentimes they would take animals and they would cut these animals and they would put them in half and lay them down, and they would walk between the parts of the animal. You think, well, that's kind of weird, isn't it? It is weird. But part of what they would do is they would take this oath, and then they would swear to the gods, and they would take the oath that was written between the king and the vassal and say, okay, we're going to take these and we're going to place them in the temples of our gods. And the gods are going to watch over the oaths. Because you don't just simply swear by yourself, you swear by the gods. Well, why? Because the god is watching over. And if you don't keep the oath, in some sense you say, what happened to these animals is going to happen to me. And so it was a way that they did it. They would often take these oaths. And that's in some sense what we do when we swear in the Bible. We're saying, you know, if I swear in the Bible, you know, so help me God. It's in some sense saying, God is going to watch over this. If I don't keep it, I'm going to suffer the punishment of God. And the idea behind it is, if I do it that way, I'm more likely to keep it. Doesn't always work that way now, does it? But the point is, this is what he's doing. But so God swears by himself. And you think, well, people swear by a greater power. Is there any greater power than God? No. So God can't swear by any greater power. So he swears by himself. And so God makes the oath. And it says, because God wanted to make the unchanging nature of his purpose very clear to the heirs of what was promised, he confirmed it with an oath. So God takes this oath to show the unchanging nature of his promise. To say this promise won't change. And what's interesting is it's saying here to make the unchanging nature of his purpose very clear to, not to Abraham, but to the heirs of what was promised. So the oath isn't just for Abraham. It's for Abraham in the moment when he swears and makes an oath with Abraham. The oath is for Abraham, but it's also for the heirs. So God displays his unchanging nature to his all heirs. And here's the thing. We are part of the family connected to Abraham. We are heirs to that promise. And so when he makes the unchanging nature of his purpose very clear to the heirs of what was promised, go back to what was one of the promises to Abraham? Descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky. And so when we look around the world today and look back through history and see the billions of people who follow Jesus who are spiritual heirs and descendants of Abraham, we see what? The promise has been fulfilled. It's being fulfilled. In fact, the fact that we're sitting here today as part of the family of God is evidence that God can be trusted. That a promise God made 3,000 years ago, he still keeps that promise. There's promises I made 2 weeks ago. I don't even remember I made them. There's other promises I broke. But God made a promise 3,000 years ago, and he swore by himself, and he has not broken that promise. And so the writer's telling us, when God has made a promise, he will keep it. Whatever that promise is. And so it's a reminder. So when we say, have patience, have faith, have trust in God, it's reminding us who you're having faith in, who you're having patience in. It took Abraham 25 years to see his promise fulfilled. For some people, it takes even longer. Abraham never saw a great nation. When he died, he had one son. It wasn't a nation. He wasn't living in the land that God had promised, but the promise still held true. And so what it's getting at is when we think and we say, well, God has promised me something. And here God hasn't promised you a new car. God hasn't promised you a better, but God has promised you what? Eternal life with him. God has promised you faith. He's promised you hope. He's promised you peace. He's promised you all these things in Jesus Christ. But sometimes it takes patience. Sometimes the promises don't come true right away. And so we're called to faith and patience. We say, well, how do I have that? We have that not because of our own ability. We don't have it because we're just filled with wells of patience and faith. We can have patience and faith because God is trustworthy. We have faith because God is faithful. We can have patience because we know God will fulfill it, even if it takes a long, long time. We can have confidence because of God's unchanging nature. So as Amy Peeler says it this way, she says, there is a simplicity in God, not hope and then action, but a divine plan that is the guarantee of the realization of that plan. In other words, when God makes a plan, it's a guarantee the plan will be realized. We make plans, and then we kind of hope, well, I hope it all works out. We might plan a trip. We might plan a business. We might plan whatever it is. We'll make this plan, and then there's hope and then action. But God makes a divine plan, and it's guarantees when he makes that plan, it's realized. And then his oath is that encouragement for you. He said, God did this, in other words, made that oath, so that by two unchangeable things, that is God's will and his oath, in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled to take hold of the hope set before us may be greatly encouraged. In other words, what he tells us is true. There's no false advertising with God. We don't need to read the small print. We don't need to wonder if when God says something that it's true, but he's sworn this oath. He says, God cannot lie, and so he's given us this hope. And because he doesn't lie, the hope he invites us to hold on to is a real hope. And there are a lot of false hopes in the world. There are lots of things. Well, we put our hope in that. We put our hope in something. We say, oh, that. And then we realize what we hoped in doesn't come true. Because so many hopes turn out to be false hopes. And so he's moving us along this path. And now what's this hope that we're called to hold on to? What's this hope we're called to grasp onto? And he says, we have this hope as an anchor for the soul, firm and secure. It enters the inner sanctuary behind the curtain. And we think, wait a minute. Because this is a weird anchor. I'm not a big boater. I don't spend a lot of time. But I know something about anchors. You take a boat out, and where do you put the anchor? In the water, right? And hopefully the anchor goes where? To the bottom. Do you put the anchor behind a curtain?
No.
In a sanctuary? I mean, what in the world is going on there? So we've got an anchor, but when you put an anchor down, what do you hope the anchor will do? And you want the anchor to what? Stay in one place, right? So now we have this hope as an anchor, and the anchor enters the inner sanctuary. So we have a moving anchor now. You think, kind of weird, isn't it? And then we get to the point, and then the verse continues on, where our forerunner, Jesus, we think, oh, no. So he's making the point, well, Jesus has entered on our behalf. So well, wait a minute now. So the anchor is Jesus, who entered the inner sanctuary, and then we come back to our friend Melchizedek. He has become a high priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. Next week, right? Okay, so what's the anchor that we're talking about? He says there's this anchor that's firm and secure, this really weird anchor that doesn't stay still, but it enters the inner sanctuary. The inner sanctuary of where? The Holy of Holies. So if we imagine again this place where the temple, the tabernacle where God was, there was a series of different kind of concentric rings, concentric places, and the priests could go into one. And the most central part of it, this tent, which had this giant curtain in front of it, was the Holy of Holies. In there was the Ark of the Covenant. And this was the place of God's presence where the high priest could enter once a year. And so now we're having this picture of the anchor, who is Jesus, entering into the inner sanctuary. In other words, entering into God's presence. And so what we see is this. There is a steadfast and certain, firm and secure anchor for our soul. For our soul, that part of us that might waver and lose commitment. And it's something that holds us in the time of the storm. But how does the anchor hold us? I mean, why is it important that it's entered there? So where did the anchor go? The anchor went into the inner sanctuary. And what's, or who is in the inner sanctuary? God is. And what have we just been told about God? That he's absolutely trustworthy. That his promises never fail. So now we're saying, what's the hope? Where does our hope come from? It comes from we have an anchor that's entered into the presence of God, the absolutely trustworthy one. What's one other thing about an anchor that's important? Rope. It's got to be attached to the boat, right? If you're standing on a boat and you just toss the anchor in the water, it's not going to hold you very well. But what? The boat needs to be tethered to the anchor, right? And so it's not just Jesus' anchor and he goes in there, but in some sense, we're attached to Jesus. We're tethered to Jesus, and he's gone in and provided an anchor for our soul. Because he's gone into the holy place, he's anchoring us. And when we put our anchor down with our boat, we want it to latch onto something solid, right? I mean, if it's just in seaweed or sand, it's just going to drag along. But he's saying this anchor for our soul, this Jesus has entered in, and he's anchoring us to God who is unchangeable. He's anchoring us to God who always keeps his promises. He's anchoring us to the God who swore by himself. And he's saying, this is where we've gone. And so we keep this in mind about what's going on, that Jesus understands us. And this goes back to chapter 2. Jesus understands us. He was a human being. He understands what it's like. He understands the temptations and the challenge. And now he's entered into God's presence. He's entered into God's rest, the place we are called to go to. And then he's provided us an anchor so that we don't drift. So that we don't, he's gone on our behalf and he's advocating for us. He's helping us. He's providing us the encouragement. And that's the encouragement that it talks about there. God did this so that we may be greatly encouraged to take hold of this hope. He's saying that Jesus, the fulfillment of unbreakable promises, anchors us to God. And so he's painting this big picture going way back to the beginning. We struggle with immaturity. We're called to maturity. Immaturity requires faith and patience. And how do we maintain, or how do we cultivate, how do we grow in faith and patience? By knowing that God is trustworthy. And we know God is trustworthy because we've seen it in the story of Abraham. But more than that, now we have Jesus who is anchoring us to it. And so as we grow in our life with Jesus, as we remain attached to Jesus, we're anchoring ourselves in those promises. As we seek to press on, as we seek to maturity, and we drift, we can take hold of God's promises. But promises can seem vague. I mean, there's some of these like, hold on to hope. And you think, well, what does hope look like? What do promises look like? But we're reminded not to simply remind, we're not called to simply hold on to hope. But then he tells us, hope is holding on to Jesus. That the hope of promises fulfilled can seem ephemeral. It can seem weighty. But the hope we cling to isn't just an idea. Because sometimes we think, oh, I just hang on. But we're not clinging simply to an idea. We're taking hold of a person. And so I like when the writer in the letter to 1 John says this, that which from the beginning which we have heard, which we have seen with ours, which we have looked at and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. He goes back and he said, if we think about the preacher's message, he said, press on to maturity. We can't stay where we're growing. We have to grow in maturity, but it's hard because there's discouragement, there's troubles, there's struggles, there's trials. There's all these things going through life. But we're called to press on. And what encourages, what keeps our commitment is faith and patience. And growing in faith and patience, how do we cultivate that? By knowing that God is one who keeps his promises. That God is completely trustworthy. You say, okay, that's good. But how do I hold on to that? You hold on to that by holding on to Jesus, because Jesus is our anchor who's gone in before us. And so he's calling us to simply hold on to Jesus, whatever that looks like. It's growing in our relationship. It's reading our Bible. It's praying. It's reminding ourselves that our hope our trust is in him. It's not in our own abilities. Our hope, our confidence, our trust is in Jesus, the one who has gone in, who understands, the one who gave his death, his life on a cross for us, the one who died and rose again, the one who now stands before the Father. This is what we're holding on to. And that provides the anchor for our soul. He's the one who understands us. He's the one who anchors us to God. And so as we go through life, as we're pressing on maturity and we need faith and we need patience, remind yourselves that Jesus is the anchor. That he's gone into God's presence. He shows us what it's like and he's there. He's there praying for us. He's there holding on. He's there reaching out his hand. We're tethered to him. It's not about our own efforts, but about what he has done. And so may we remain anchored in Jesus. May we remain tied to him as he anchors us in God's unchangeable promises. Amen.